you are dust, and to dust you shall return.
The nation says farewell to our 39th president. Jimmy Carter, a man of faith, leaves a complicated legacy on same-sex marriage and abortion. We discuss his political and social impact. What's described as a hellscape in Southern California, as Santa Ana winds fuel devastating wildfires across the most populous county in America.
Oh my God. My relationship with Jesus is the most important thing in my life.
And a spiritual jumpstart to the new year, as thousands of young people come together to encounter God, some for the very first time. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
An iconic and sunny destination turns apocalyptic. Thousands of homes decimated, schools and places of worship charred beyond recognition. Entire communities turned to ash. Countless lives upended, some lost. And tens of thousands of residents stuck in gridlock on the highways as they attempt to escape. This is the scene in Southern California as it faces its most devastating and widespread wildfires in recent history. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado in This Week for Catherine Hadro. Los Angeles, the most populated county in the nation, is no stranger to wildfires, but a dangerous combination of unusually strong Santa Ana winds, intense drought, and dry vegetation have made these fires some of the most destructive in California history. Brush fire first broke out in the Pacific Palisades on Tuesday. Within hours, three more fires were reported, and on Wednesday night, the Hollywood Hills also erupted in flame. Beloved landmarks like the Getty Museum were wreathed in dark smoke. Fire hydrants in the Palisades ran dry because demand for water was so high. Thursday brought a reprieve from the intense winds, giving firefighters, exhausted and stretched thin, a chance to make progress against the blaze and allowing some residents to return home. But meteorologists warn the dangerously dry and windy conditions are not ending anytime soon.
The main message here is that with more bouts of offshore winds, Santa Ana winds, next week periodically coming up and down, we're going to have more cases of elevated to critical fire weather conditions across the region. I can't emphasize it enough.
The California National Guard, as well as firefighters from Northern California and out of state, have traveled to Los Angeles to help. But even after the fires are completely contained, residents could deal with poor air quality and contaminated water for weeks to come. President Biden has approved a major disaster declaration for California, allowing for federal funding for temporary housing, home repairs, and loans to cover uninsured property losses. Biden was in California on Wednesday, where he and Governor Gavin Newsom received a briefing on the catastrophe from police, fire, and emergency personnel. Late Wednesday, the White House announced the severity of the wildfires prompted the president to cancel what was to be a final foreign trip of his presidency this weekend, a cherished visit with Pope Francis at the Vatican. The president says he will remain in Washington to monitor the federal response to the devastating fires. At the time of this recording, six fires have broken out. The first and most destructive fire in the Palisades to the west scorched more than 20,000 acres and more than 5,000 buildings. Firefighters so far have only been able to contain the Sunset Fire in the Hollywood Hills. Combined, these fires have spread more than 35,000 acres. Nearly 180,000 residents are under evacuation orders. Thousands more are under evacuation warnings. 10 people are reported dead, but officials say they simply don't know the true death toll. The region's historically devastating fires come with a hefty price tag, with economic losses climbing higher than $135 billion. Pablo Kay joins us now to share how Southern California's Catholic community is faring. He's the editor-in-chief of Angeles News, the multimedia news platform of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. Pablo, first, how are you and your family faring?
Hi, Monse. My family and I are doing fine, thank God.
Praise God for that. What is the latest then from the Archdiocese? Angelus has reported that some churches have been destroyed. You've had some incredible posts on Instagram that are showing the images of what is really happening there in the true devastation.
Yeah, so one parish destroyed, Corpus Christi in the Pacific Palisades, the first major fire that broke out. And then a couple other parishes came very close to being destroyed. The flames got very close. And in one case, in Altadena, the Eden Fire, which is kind of the second major fire that broke out, it was really thanks to a deacon who used a low-pressure garden hose and a ladder to put out a fire that started on a roof that would have taken over the whole church. Then there's also a retreat center that was damaged but not destroyed. And like I said, a couple other parishes that were close to the flames, but it looks like are going to make it.
Well, that's really good to hear. I also know that there are parishes who are supporting victims of the wildfire, serving as places for evacuation. What can you tell us about the way that the church is opening up its arms to receive those who are affected by this?
Right. I think the situation is changing by the day, and I think parishes and also schools are responding to the different needs. The biggest need right now, I think, is for families that have been evacuated, for, you know, food supplies, children, families with children need things like diapers, clothes, things like that. It seems that a lot of the evacuated people are either finding shelter at public shelters or with friends or family. And so we're seeing a few high schools in the area and parishes getting just tons of people showing up to donate whatever they can, and then people in need also showing up to pick up.
Now, Los Angeles truly has never seen devastation like this. You've been there for a long time. How do you lean on your faith during times of trial like this?
I think that God prepares you for these kinds of things. And he gives you what you need. So I see how he's helping me in ways that I don't even realize in the moment, right? So I you lean on your faith, and you have to, it's really, it puts everything in perspective. And I'm realizing that it just, when God offers you the help, the grace, you got to take it.
Now, Pablo, I know you're tired. I know that your team is tired. What can you tell us about how it affects you reporting on this? A lot of people don't think about the reporters on the front lines that are getting emergency information out, everything that people need to know about where to evacuate, where they can find resources. How is that affecting you and your team?
I haven't had time to think about it. You just try to, roll with the punches and do the best you can. You know, we just try to get the information out there and adjust. But I mean, I'm sitting at a desk right now. I took a hot shower this morning in my house. I was able to sleep for a few hours. Meanwhile, there's people who have lost everything. There are firefighters who have been working nonstop. I don't know how they're doing it. So that kind of puts things in perspective.
Absolutely. When you think about the response of the Archdiocese, is there going to be a call to prayer? We saw Jonathan Rumi came out with a new novena on Hallow just for the people in Los Angeles. What is the Archdiocese planning to do? Do you know?
Well, I think most churches are doing, in the situations that are possible, are keeping their churches open, are keeping, you know, the regular mass and confession times. And then Archbishop Gomez here, along with his auxiliary bishops, I mean, they seem to be going nonstop, having masses every day, to pray for victims, for, first responders. Yesterday, I was at a mass at the cathedral that was originally supposed to be in Santa Monica, close to the Palisades fire. And there were dozens of parishioners from this parish, Corpus Christi, that burned down. And almost all the ones that I talked to had also lost their homes, everything gone.
That's crazy. I can't imagine that. Well, Pablo, can you tell us quickly where can we send people and direct people to support the LA Archdiocese efforts to help those who are in desperate need?
You go to angelusnews.com or lacatholics.org. You'll see a list of resources there on the homepage. And like I said, we're just trying to keep that information updated because it's changing every day. There's new opportunities popping up.
Pablo, thank you for your heroic work. We're praying for you and everyone in this dire situation. God bless you.
Thank you, Monsi.
Of course. If you would like to help support those affected by the wildfires, the Los Angeles Archdiocese recommends donations to Catholic Charities USA, the California Fire Foundation, or the American Red Cross Los Angeles chapter. Next on EWTN News in Depth, all of America's living presidents gather at Washington's National Cathedral to honor the man from Plains, Georgia.
Jimmy Carter's enduring attribute, character. 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 Because of that character, I believe, is destiny.
When we return, thoughts on the life of a humble man who held the world's highest office, and a look from a Catholic perspective at the complex legacy he left behind.
For one of our nation's most religious presidents, it's appropriate to celebrate Jimmy Carter's remarkable life in this magnificent cathedral.
From former White House advisors who interacted with him on a daily basis, to a sitting president, to beloved family members, President Jimmy Carter is eulogized on Thursday during his state funeral in Washington, D.C., before his final burial in Plains, Georgia, beside Rosalynn, his wife of 77 years. The humble man from Plains, Georgia, died at his home on December 29th at the age of 100 after more than a year of hospice care. Some of the most touching reflections at his state funeral on Thursday came from his grandchildren.
My grandfather started teaching Sunday school when he was a midshipman at the Naval Academy. He taught the Bible every Sunday from World War II to COVID. For all my grandfather's travels, he structured his life so that he was home in Plains to teach at Maranatha on Sunday. It was central to his life.
Grandson Jason Carter is the chairman of the Carter Center in Atlanta.
They were small town people who never forgot who they were and where they were from, no matter what happened in their lives. In both public and private, my grandparents did fundamentally live their lives in an effort, as the Bible says, to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with their God.
The homily, from a preacher who had known him for more than 50 years, civil rights legend and former United Nations ambassador, the Reverend Andrew Young.
He never wavered from his commitment to God Almighty and his love of all of God's children. Jimmy Carter was a blessing that helped to create a great United States of America.
Jimmy Carter has the distinction of being the first U.S. president to host a pope at the White House. In October 1979, Pope John Paul II accepted Carter's invitation during his first papal pilgrimage to the United States. It was a White House meeting Time magazine called inconceivable had it been attempted just years before. The two men agreed to speak to one another not as diplomats, but as Christian brothers, and met privately in the Oval Office for an hour. According to the president's White House diary, the pope encouraged the U.S. to reach out more to the largely Catholic population of Eastern Europe, then under Soviet domination, a reflection of Carter's own human rights agenda. Before an assembled crowd on the South Lawn, the pontiff said he came as a messenger of peace and brotherhood. When he ended his remarks by proclaiming, "God bless America," the 6,000 invited guests rose to their feet in thunderous applause. Less than a year later, President Carter had another in-person meeting with John Paul II during a visit to the Vatican at the height of the 1980 presidential election. The two again used the opportunity to emphasize a need to protect human rights. Top of mind for Carter was the Soviet Union's recent invasion of Afghanistan. The Pope expressed his concern for peace in the Middle East and the plight of the Palestinians. After Carter's death on December 29th, Pope Francis offered his condolences, praising the former president's deep Christian faith and his lifelong mission to advance peace and human rights. Carter was widely known as a man whose life was guided by his Baptist faith. As a candidate for president in 1976, he described himself as a born-again Christian long before the evangelical movement had become a political force. Yet for Catholics who follow the tenets of Catholic Church teaching, Carter's presidency and the evolution of his public policy stances in the decades afterward present a mixed and complex legacy. To help us examine the Carter legacy from a Catholic perspective, we're joined by Dr. Kenneth Craycraft, professor of moral theology at Mount St. Mary's Seminary and School of Theology in Cincinnati, Ohio. He writes frequently on the intersection of the Catholic faith and politics. Ken, it's so great to have you back. There's no doubt that Jimmy Carter was a devout man. His faith defined his life. How would you say his religious beliefs impacted his presidency?
Oh, I think they had a direct impact, perhaps more than any other president in American history. I mean, you could think of people like Ronald Reagan, for example, who certainly had a deep Christian faith. But for Carter, it was more express and more explicit. And his Christian faith had more of a purchase over his personal life, and therefore it had more of a purchase over his public life. And so as president, he did bring to bear those things as he understood them as a Southern Baptist, which were essential to Christian faith, related to justice and to charity and to all of those things that we include in the catalog of Christian virtues. And I don't think there's any question that he did that, and that he tried to do that in a way that perhaps was unique in American history for an American president. Whether he was successful or not is for history to judge. But I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever that perhaps more than any other president in American history, he brought express Christian faith to bear on the decisions that he made in the Oval Office. And for that, he should be commended. And his memory should be a good one for that reason alone, as well as other things.
Now, Ken, Carter lived for 100 years and had a 40-year post-presidency. Different people, different generations perceive the impact of his influence depending on when they stepped into that moment in his life. How would you define those different perceptions and the way that his legacy is received?
Well, yeah, immediately after he left the Oval Office, he was sort of an ambassador at large for the United States. And I know that a lot of people criticized his foreign policy because he was, let's say, cooler to Israel, as typical American, official American policy is, and perhaps too friendly to regimes that were not friendly to Israel. So this is one way that his perception throughout history has been sort of a mixed bag for that reason in his foreign policy positions. On the other hand, however, most people know him with a hammer in his hand and a tool bag on his hip, building houses for Habitat Humanity. He was involved in that for his entire life, and those projects which he spearheaded and which he hammered the nails and he sawed the wood, a lot of people know him for that and have a great admiration for him because he did put his faith to practice and he put his money where his mouth was when it came to that. And I think those are the two things that are sort of a mixed legacy for Carter. Pundits will see his foreign policy positions as somewhat problematic, but the general public sees him as a Christian man doing good for others, and Habitat Humanity was the major way that he did that. He didn't do it to bring attention to himself. As a former president, the attention came to him, but he humbly did it, and he did it in a way that was authentic, I think, an authentic act of charity. And again, for that, he's to be commended.
Now, one thing is the way that the rest of the world saw him, and the other thing is the way that the Christian community saw him, mm-hmm. the broader Christian community. In this long tenure, Christian denominations and the Catholic Church really shifted how they advocated for life and the family, the Catholic Church in particular becoming much more clear about what we believe and how we believe it. How were his Christian views in line or not in line with the Catholic Church over time?
Well, I think in the early days of his public life, he was a committed pro-life person. He was committed pro-life president or governor of Georgia and a committed pro-life president in his one term as president. However, like his denomination and like Democrat politics in general, it tended to shift over the years toward having lesser of an understanding of the dignity of life and more importantly, from the Catholic perspective, the connection of sexual morals with the propagation of life, with new life. And because he didn't have that firm connection, I think, as a Protestant, then he didn't have the foundation that I think that he might have had to be more consistently pro-life and anti-abortion throughout his presidency and throughout his post-presidency. And as his party drifted, he seemed to drift a little bit with them. And so it was sad to see him compromise on things like abortion and other related life issues. But again, I think from a Catholic standpoint, the problem is a more general one, that he simply didn't have the theological foundation to see abortion not just as a justice issue, which of course it is, but also life, new life related to marriage and sexuality, which no evangelical Protestant theology really has a way to account for that, and therefore doesn't have that way of accounting for the need to protect unborn life. And I think that was a shortcoming, and as his party drifted, he drifted with the party simply because, again, he didn't have that infrastructure to be able to give a rationale for why abortion is wrong in every instance, regardless of what the party says.
Now, leaning into this issue of shifting views, how were his shifting views emblematic of this decline of the influence of Christian values in America? A lot of people say that the end of Christendom came over that time when he was truly influential.
Yeah, we've seen a radical shift toward secularism, and I don't want to say toward the right or toward the left, but toward secularism in the United States. I don't think that Jimmy Carter went that far, but I do think that his politics and even his persona, his public life, was definitely affected by that. I don't think his faith weakened at all, but I do think that the positions that he took were somehow not insulated from that drift toward a more secular society that we live in today, and it might have had an impact upon the way that he thought over time. Again, this is not in any way at all to question his personal Christian faith, but the positions that flowed from it did seem to be affected by a drift towards secularism. And if you look at any poll, I'm not saying anything controversial or even partisan, the Democrat Party is more secular, Democrats identify less as religious people than Republicans and some independents. And I think that Carter was affected by that in a way that was perhaps regrettable. Again, not questioning the integrity of his own personal faith, but looking at the positions that he took, how could they not have been affected by the secular drift of his own party? And I think that we did see that.
Absolutely. The reality is that if you had a stickier Christian culture, his shifting views wouldn't have had as much of an effect. Well, Ken, we're so grateful for your analysis and your commentary, and we're looking forward to having you on again soon.
Thank you, Monsi. Take care.
Of course. And here's a point of interest for all of you watching this program today. The Carter administration actually played a part in the founding of our television network, EWTN. During his term in office, the Federal Communications Commission approved Mother Angelica's request for a broadcast license. In November of 1980, the nuns of Our Lady of the Angels Monastery sent in an application to the FCC, but their lawyer warned that they might have to wait months to secure the broadcast license. To their surprise and joy, the then lame duck Carter administration granted them their license in January of 1981, within days of Ronald Reagan being sworn in as president. No one was quite sure how or why the administration gave permission so quickly for operation of the first Catholic satellite television network in the U.S., but for Mother Angelica, it was simply another sign of God's providence. In August of that year, the Eternal Word television network hit the airwaves. The next occupant of the White House, Donald Trump, will be joined by a new Catholic leader in Washington. Pope Francis has named Cardinal Robert McElroy to lead the Archdiocese of Washington. Cardinal McElroy appeared alongside Cardinal Gregory at a press conference on Monday. A California native, 70-year-old McElroy has led the Diocese of San Diego since 2015 and was elevated a cardinal in 2022. He has been vocal on many controversial issues at the intersection of politics and culture, including pro-abortion Catholic politicians receiving communion, advocacy for LGBTQ-identifying Catholics, and most notably, immigration. In this new role, he will have to reckon with the Archdiocese's financial issues and the continued effects of the sexual abuse crisis. Cardinal McElroy will be officially installed as the Archbishop at a Mass on March 11th. With McElroy's appointment comes the announcement of Cardinal Gregory's retirement from the Archdiocese of Washington. He took over the Archdiocese in 2019 as it was reeling from the revelations of sexual abuse by former D.C. Archbishop Theodore McCarrick. Cardinal Gregory initially submitted his resignation to the Pope more than 2 years ago when he turned 75, but the search for his replacement has been a lengthy process. Gregory will temporarily serve as the apostolic administrator of the Archdiocese until McElroy's installation. He says he will stay in Washington to assist in any way he can. In other major news from the Vatican, for the first time in history, Pope Francis has named a woman to head a Vatican dicastery. Sister Simona Brambilla will head the dicastery for Institutes of Consecrated Life and Societies of Apostolic Life. She previously served as the former Superior General of her order, the Consolata Missionary Sisters, and has been the Secretary of the Vatican Department for Religious and Consecrated Life since 2023. She's just one of many religious and non-religious laywomen the Holy Father has appointed to important posts at the Vatican. And on this second anniversary of his death, we remember the passing of Cardinal George Pell. The Australian Cardinal spoke to us here on EWTN News in Depth in December 2021 to share his insights of his time in prison after he was cleared of what some say now were malicious abuse charges against him. Pell was a remarkable and beloved leader of the Catholic Church, remembered for his legacy and for his advocacy for the magisterium. May his soul rest in eternal peace. We'll be right back with news headlines in the Week in Review and this.
Leading the March for Life will be my job. It's really our family's calling.
A preview of our conversation with both the current and incoming leaders of the annual March for Life. And later,
at the annual SEEK conference, there's a lot of excitement amongst young Catholics and plenty of school spirit. I'm Mark Irons. We've got that story coming up.
A major Supreme Court case about the most downloaded app in the United States tops the Week in Review. The fate of the social media platform TikTok is now in the hands of the justices as they weigh whether an impending ban violates free speech. The bipartisan law requires TikTok's Chinese parent company, ByteDance, to sell the app or lose access to app stores and web hosting services in the United States. The federal government and lawmakers say TikTok poses a national security threat thanks to its ties to China. But TikTok challenges that the ban violates the First Amendment rights of both the app and its 170 million users. During argument, justices on both sides of the aisle seemed skeptical of TikTok's case.
We want to use the algorithm that we think reflects the best mix of content. That's the algorithm that reflects the best mix of content. What this law says is we can't do that unless ByteDance exercises a qualified divestiture. But I also think more directly what this law does is it says to TikTok Incorporated, if ByteDance doesn't exercise a qualified divestiture, you have to go mute. You cannot speak at all.
No, I don't think it says that, though. I mean, if TikTok were to post-divestiture or whatever, pre-divestiture, come up with its own algorithm, right, then when the divestiture happened, it could still operate. It doesn't say TikTok, you can't speak.
A ruling is expected before the law goes into effect next week. TikTok has become a powerhouse platform, providing entertainment and information to millions of young Americans and producing a steady flow of revenue for content creators and advertisers. Next week, the Supreme Court will hear oral argument for another high-profile case, this one concerning a Texas law that requires websites to verify the age of their users if their content is deemed harmful to minors, in particular, pornography. Later in the term, the justices will tackle the case of Catholic Charities in Wisconsin and whether its work to serve the poor and needy is religious. We'll continue to provide updates as these cases progress. A district court in Kentucky has struck down President Biden's Title IX rewrite. The rule reinterpreted the Title IX ban on sex discrimination to include gender identity, though the term does not appear in the original 1972 law. Many worried the controversial rule would end sex-based protections for biological women in education and sports. The Kentucky judge ruled the interpretation to be unconstitutional and said including gender identity renders the original statute meaningless. With President-elect Trump taking office in less than 2 weeks, an appeal from the federal government is highly unlikely. A mournful new year in New Orleans, where President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden attended an interfaith memorial service for those lost in a brutal terrorist truck attack. Joyful New Year's Eve celebrations on the iconic Bourbon Street turned into a crime scene when a man drove a pickup truck into crowds, killing 14 people and injuring dozens more. The FBI says the now deceased terror suspect was radicalized, acted alone, and planned the attack months in advance, even planting two explosives on Bourbon Street that never detonated. At the memorial service on Monday, Biden told the community to remain resilient and not lose hope. U.S. Steel and Japan's Nippon Steel filed a lawsuit against the U.S. government on Monday after President Biden blocked their more than $14 billion merger last week. The two major steel producers sought the merger to compete globally with China's larger companies. Biden stopped the merger to protect domestic production and national security, but the two steel manufacturers claim this move was purely political. Both Biden and President-elect Trump promised Pittsburgh voters to keep the steel producer American-owned on the campaign trail last year, though the two companies hope Trump can be convinced to let the deal move forward. Canada's political world is upended after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced his resignation on Monday. His departure comes after dwindled public approval, a polarized parliament, and mounting pressure from his own party to step down. Trudeau rose to power nearly a decade ago and led the charge on issues like climate change and the historic abuses against Indigenous people. But in recent years, his tenure has been clouded by economic woes, concerns over immigration, and the growing popularity of the opposing conservative narrative. In December, Trudeau faced a heavy blow when his deputy prime minister and finance minister resigned and accused him of, quote, costly political gimmicks. At a press conference in Ontario on Monday, he told Canada it's time for a reset.
And the reset that we have is actually two parts. One is the prorogation, but the other part is recognizing that removing me from the equation as the leader who will fight the next election for the Liberal Party should also decrease the level of polarization that we're seeing right now in the House and in Canadian politics and allow people to actually focus on serving Canadians in this House and with their work the way Canadians deserve.
Canada's parliament is suspended until March 24th. Trudeau will continue to serve as Liberal Party leader and prime minister until his replacement is named through a competitive nationwide party election. We're less than 2 weeks away from the 52nd annual March for Life, the nation's largest gathering of pro-life advocates. Thousands are expected to flock to Washington, D.C. to march in defense of the unborn. Can't make it to D.C. for the March for Life? EWTN will bring you there with our live team coverage. Join us on Friday, January 24th at 9:30 a.m. as we follow the marchers through the Capitol, speak with pro-life leaders, and pray for the protection of life. This year, the March for Life will undergo an exciting transition as longtime President Jeannie Mancini passes the baton to a new leader, Jenny Bradley Lichter. I recently sat down with both Jeannie and Jenny to reflect on this year's march and the future of the pro-life movement.
I want to ask you both about this theme, life, why we march. Let's start with you, Jeannie. What does this theme mean to you?
Yeah. So every year when we're choosing a theme, we really try to speak into what's happening in the culture because, of course, the March for Life is where all of the different pro-life groups come together, and really choosing a theme gives us a springboard to impact whatever's happening. Like, what are the most pressing needs? And perhaps not surprisingly, I mean, people are discouraged right now. That's our sense, at least, that we've had this massive victory of the overturn of Roe, but we've lost at the state in a number of these ballot initiatives. We've seen elected officials separate themselves from this issue. And people are wondering even about the abortion numbers. We want to encourage marchers. We want to remind them that they're on the right side of history. one of the best ways to do that is to return to the basics, kind of pro-life 101. Why are we pro-life? And then also, why are you pro-life? You know, people's stories are so powerful. And for over 10 years at the March, we've had this hashtag for all of our social media endeavors, which is why we march. And that is really an invitation for marchers to tell their story. And those, every story is unique, and those stories are beautiful. And so that's really the hope with the theme.
It's a beautiful personal witness. Well, Jenny, walking into this for you, what does that resonate with you, that theme? Would you have chosen the same?
Yes, absolutely. I think Jeannie explained the theme wonderfully and why the organization chose it. For me personally, it's a really meaningful theme for my first March for Life at the organization because I have been a marcher since 2001. I've attended many marches for life in the past number of years.
When you think about the future of the march and what you're inheriting, is there something that makes you nervous or excited?
Oh gosh, I'm so excited. I mean, I've been coming to the March for Life for so many years, and it's so special to me. And I have admired first Nellie Gray when I first started attending the march, and then Jeannie for so many years have just watched her and admired her leadership of the march at the event itself and in the media and all the ways in which she has led in the pro-life movement. So I am honestly just floored that this call came to me. And I'm so grateful to Jeannie for trusting me and asking me to consider this and to the Lord for opening my heart to saying yes to it. And I just am so excited and humbled by this opportunity. I really can't wait to get started.
There's much more to my conversation with Jenny and Jeannie. I asked Jenny how motherhood is shaping her new role and how she's making the march a family business. You can hear that and more in a special episode of EWTN Pro-Life Weekly next Friday at 8 p.m. Eastern during In-Depth's regular airtime. And an update to a story we brought you last week, more than 500,000 pilgrims from all over the world have already walked through the Holy Door of St. Peter's Basilica for the Year of Jubilee. Pope Francis began the year-long celebration by opening and walking through the Holy Door on Christmas Eve. The Holy Doors have been a Jubilee tradition in the Church for centuries, and pilgrims can gain a plenary indulgence by passing through them. Four Holy Doors are located at Roman basilicas. The Holy Father also opened a fifth special one at a Roman prison. The doors will remain open throughout the Jubilee year for the millions of anticipated pilgrims journeying to Rome.
It gives us the opportunity to say, what have we been doing to share our faith? What have we been doing to give people a real experience of their faith?
Who says young people are turning away from religion? Thousands seeking spiritual fulfillment are reinforced in their faith at an annual conference. We take you there next.
The beginning of the year marks an important annual event for many young Catholics looking to strengthen their faith. SEEK is a multi-day conference organized by the Fellowship of Catholic University Students, and this year it was held in two locations in the U.S. My colleague Mark Irons and I were both at the SEEK convention. I was at the Salt Lake City location, and Mark was in Washington, D.C. It was really an inspiring event, wasn't
it? Was amazing and a great way to start the year, Mom said.
Yeah.
You know, despite what some surveys show about church attendance being low, we met thousands of young people who are putting God first and practicing their religion. Many of them could have started this new year enjoying a winter break from college classes, but instead, they decided to focus on their faith and this Catholic life.
The sounds of worship, friendship, and faith found here are different than what you'll hear in some of the data that young people are leaving organized religion in droves.
Thousands of young people are proving those statistics wrong here at SEEK. Let's go find out what it's all about.
With school pride flying high, crowds of college students and young adults from every corner of the country came together for SEEK, an annual Catholic conference put on by Focus, a group that places Catholic student missionaries on college campuses.
Like, where are you from?
University of Delaware.
The multi-day conference drew more than 20,000 attendees between three location sites in Salt Lake City, Washington, D.C., and even Cologne, Germany. In D.C., participants described this spiritual jumpstart to their new year.
It's amazing.
It's amazing?
This is probably the most Catholic people I've ever been around in my life, and everywhere you go, it's just good people.
And they're hearing the good news.
With Christ, you and I are redeemed.
It's because of him that we're redeemed.
Every sin is an attempt to be happy apart from God. I need religion. I need to be bound back to him. I need to say, God, please bind me to you.
Between the speakers and sacraments, these students are receiving something countercultural, rejected by many of their peers.
What do you say to those people that don't practice their faith, don't want to practice religion, they're young and they say it's a waste of time?
Give it a chance one more time, because at the end of the day, all those other things, all those other worldly pleasures that you can get involved in, it's only going to give you temporary pleasure. Well, when you're with one in union with Christ, with his church, that's when you find eternal happiness.
Life without practicing your faith is definitely meaningless. So it's important to center ourselves around the truth and live it.
Many of the attendees tell me that despite what the culture might say about what will make them happy or fulfilled, they know the truth, and he has a name.
Jesus is the most important thing in my life.
Felicia, a Catholic from Pennsylvania, says coming to this conference helps reinvigorate her faith. She says her life changed 4 years ago when she decided to make her relationship with Christ more of a priority. She turned away from what she calls a partying lifestyle in high school.
All of those things, just like they do leave you empty. Like they leave you so empty. And like Jesus really, like you can only experience it like when you are in relationship with him and you're like living a life of the sacraments and like praying like regularly.
And making that change, has it brought you peace or joy or?
Absolutely. Like, I literally cannot like explain like the, just like the satisfaction and fulfillment.
We found Felicia's reflection reinforced by others. That true adventure, freedom, joy, and peace offered by Christ and his church is something that can't be found elsewhere.
A lot of people are deceiving. A lot of people are manipulating and advertising and just kind of yanking you this way and that.
Father Gregory Pine was one of the event speakers. He believes many young adults are seeking authentic relationships with God and one another.
We're looking for communion, like we're looking to be with, because that's the whole point, is to be with and to find people who are willing to be with without using us or like, you know, just gathering assets so that they can leverage them on social media or just like blah, blah, blah. You know, it's just like we don't want that.
Many people seem to be searching for faith in 2025. At Seek, we spoke with Father Mark Mary, whose popular Rosary in a Year podcast topped the charts to kick off the new year.
Your podcast, Rosary in a Year, hit number one. You beat out Joe Rogan.
I do think it's not the popular narrative, but I do think people want God.
An opportunity for communion with God and one another came during Mass, when thousands of students received Christ fully present in the Eucharist. Long lines formed to encounter God's forgiveness in confession, and many knelt down to adore him in adoration.
Anytime I just get to sit in like Eucharistic adoration and just get to adore and not only like see him, but like feel seen by him in that moment, like really feel like he's looking at me, it's just, I can't describe it.
At a place like this, it's just great to see so many people around your age just like giving themselves up to Christ.
Young people are seeking their faith and they do care about Jesus.
Students here also had the chance to learn about many faith-based ministries and meet plenty of young religious men and women who have answered God's call to give their lives to him in a unique way.
You know, there's just a sense of belonging and peace that comes from knowing this is where I'm supposed to be.
I needed to give my whole life to God. And I wasn't going to be happy unless I gave him everything.
After Seek, young adults on any part of their faith journey are given plenty to think about.
Where do you want to grow and develop in your faith?
I want to learn more about the scripture.
Some of them have an encounter with the living God and they know that life has to change. Others of them come here and they'll think it was a spiritual high and they'll enjoy the experience, but they'll go away and perhaps we won't see them for a while.
For those young people who have stopped seeking Catholicism, the students here say look again.
God always has the time for you.
I, like, actually promise that, like, your life will change. Come and see. You don't know what you're missing out on. Just give God a chance.
Personally speaking, Monse, it was a very inspiring event and a great way to start the new year.
And it certainly wasn't your first time at Seek. We were there in St. Louis together.
Exactly, exactly.
What do you think that young people feel? Do you really think that it's true that they won't stick with it?
I think that they really feel a sense of community and communion at something like Seek, and they're really drawn in by the sacramental life of the church. You know, they're connected through the Eucharist. And to see the long lines at confession, I'm sure you saw it in Salt Lake City too, people really knowing they need the mercy of God and seeking it out, It was sort of beautiful to see that. It's inspiring. And that's the big question. Will they stay with it after this, right? Because this is inspiring, sort of a jump start to their year. Where do they go from here? It's important for them, I think, to stay connected to their communities at home.
Yeah, and I think there is a lot that we do as EWTN, but also other people do to connect with them digitally. You interviewed Father Mark Mary, whose podcast blew up.
Beat Joe Rogan, top of the charts. Not a bad way to start the new year for him. Right, and he was saying that, I was asking, why is that? Why are people tuning in and listening to these podcasts? Rosary in a year, we saw the success of the Bible in a year, Catechism in a year. He says simply people want God, right? Sometimes that's not the narrative.
Yeah.
The narrative is that the young people are turning away from faith and they're not interested, but you talk to the young folks in these crowds and you saw it. That's definitely not true.
Yeah, I mean, 3,000 people in D.C., 17,000 people in Salt Lake City. Don't tell me that God is dead.
No,
like, that's not the headline anymore.
Not at all. And that interview with Father Mark Mary, that will be posted, the full interview, so people can tune into that. But he's definitely very inspiring.
And speaking to this generation in a totally different way. So I think it's beautiful to see the devotion to Our Lady rise up and beat a political commentator, no matter what you think about him.
Right,
awesome.
Right.
Well, Mark, I look forward to being there in 2026 with you again, where we'll bring more coverage from EWTN.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it, Monse.
Yeah. Well, we'll be right back.
God does not exist, therefore I have to decide what my life is going to be about.
A scientist atheist experiences Christ on his path to becoming a Catholic priest. The faith journey of Father Peter Tyrone when we return.
Finally tonight, the path to the priesthood comes from many directions. The man leading the Catholic faithful at a prominent parish in Toronto, Canada, came to his calling on a road that took him through doubt, atheism, and the study of neuroscience. What was a shaky start is a faith now built on a very strong foundation. Correspondent Colin Flynn brings us Father Peter Tyrone's faith journey in depth.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
For someone who once didn't believe in God, Father Peter Tyrone's journey to the priesthood has been a remarkable one.
You were 19 years of age.
Yes.
And you were walking.
I said, I'm done with the church, I'm done with the religion and everything. God does not exist, therefore I have to decide what my life is going to be about.
And what he thought would disprove God ended up having the opposite effect.
So everything exists for a reason, and yet the person itself, with this complicated organism, exists for no reason at all. And I thought to myself, well, how is that possible? There's only one Lord and Savior, and his name is Jesus Christ.
Growing up in Toronto, Canada, Peter lived in a religious house. His mother was a Catholic, and his father had become a Jehovah's Witness, which caused problems.
I heard you say before it was almost frightening.
Yes. So what happened was that my dad would come home. So my dad worked for a company, and so his employees would come home. They would give my dad these books. So the Wake Watchtower, Jehovah's Witness Bible. So I had all this stuff, and their children's Bible. So I'd go to bed at night, and I would flip through everything. And a lot of it was based on fear. So I would read this, and it would also instill a fear in me. I said, I'm done with the church, I'm done with the religion and everything, because I saw my parents arguing. My parents, they love each other, but whenever they spoke of religion, it would become an argument.
There were the arguments about religion at home. And then, when his aunt was diagnosed with terminal cancer, well, if there really was a God, Peter wanted him to intervene.
So I would go and I would spend the afternoon with her. And then over the course of 11 months, I saw her going from being very healthy to withering away and dying. And I was praying and praying, and she just kept getting more and more sick. So in my immaturity of faith, I just assumed that by asking God for something that I would automatically receive what I was asking for.
After watching his aunt die in front of him, despite his pleas to God, and seeing how religion could cause arguments and division, Peter was done.
You were 19 years of age.
Yes.
And you were walking, I heard you say before, and you vividly remember saying to yourself what?
I was walking through the Eaton Center, and I said, God does not exist, therefore I have to decide for myself what my life is going to be about.
He decided to pursue a career in science and studied psychiatry.
I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm a neuroscientist. And what I did was I worked in psychiatry trying to discover why certain medications cause side effects in people with schizophrenia and how to develop treatment protocols that will reduce the symptoms so they can have a better quality of life.
And it was while in college that Peter says science started to make him reconsider the existence of God by applying the same logic and reason he used in his studies to the case for a creator.
This cell does this for this reason and everything else, but then when we stop at the human being, it's like, oh, we're just random and purposeless. We don't have an existence. We have to create on our existence. And I thought to myself, well, how is that possible? So everything exists for a reason, and yet the person itself with this complicated organism exists for no reason at all.
The more he learned about molecular biology and how nothing is left to chance, even the smallest parts of cells have a purpose, the more he started to believe in God.
I started off as an atheist when I went to university, and I rediscovered my faith in university. You don't suspend reason to be a man or a woman of faith. I think the whole universe screams of evidence of God's existence.
His mind was starting to understand how God could exist, but his heart had felt he did exist all along.
After having been away from the church, and then I went to a prayer group one night, I got invited, and there was a deacon there, and he said, you know, can we pray for you? And I said, sure. I didn't know what was going to happen, so he put his hands on my head. He was praying. And at that moment, I didn't realize that I was blind up until that moment, and I had only regained my sight then and there. And at that moment, I accepted the Lord back in my life. I accepted the church. And that's when I started feeling an immediate pull towards the Lord.
He started going to daily mass, and then one day, someone asked him a question that he was avoiding himself.
He said, what's your name? I go, it's Peter. And he said, have you ever thought about that God might be calling you to become a priest? And I was terrified, because I knew that that's what God was calling me to.
Peter stopped his work in science and started his life in seminary, and he was ordained in 2012.
The day you became a priest, what was that like?
It was the best day of my life.
Why do you say that?
What God created me to be was now coming to pass. Yeah. I felt whole. I felt I had arrived. I'd arrived home and living completely and totally for God. When I had an encounter with the Lord, I was able to just say, I realized that he was the most important person in my life.
After spending 3 years as a missionary in rural Mongolia between Russia and China, Father Peter returned to Toronto and took up the role as the pastor in the Holy Rosary Parish.
Love of Jesus Christ, and I experienced Christ's direct call to the priesthood. It's the easiest way I can explain it.
What's the best thing about being a priest?
Saying the Mass.
What's the hardest part of being a priest?
Trying to help people to recognize the beauty of the church.
These homes here are beautiful. These are multi-million dollar homes around
They're
us.
They're incredibly expensive. It's very difficult to buy a place, even to get an apartment in Toronto.
The church has its back on multi-million dollar homes, some of the most expensive in Toronto.
I would say this part is very affluent.
And it's facing a valley where the homeless live.
We have people that come to our Out of the Cold program in the church, so the doors are open for everyone, which is very encouraging to know that people can come from all over. Like, we get people coming every day to the house to get food, or we give them food cards as well.
So at your parish, in any given day, you could have someone coming in who's a multimillionaire.
Yes.
And then the next person coming
is homeless.
Is homeless.
Exactly.
Father Peter says that his life now, today as a priest, is more fulfilling than it's ever been before.
He knocks on the door. We have to open. He never forces himself. But once you open the door, and then you come to discover who he is, and life is amazing.
In Toronto, Canada, Colm Flynn for EWTN News in Depth.
A beautiful story of faith. And that's a wrap on this edition of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. Join us again next week at this time for a special report leading the March for Life and EWTN News special. It's all part of our team coverage leading up to this year's annual March for Life, our nation's biggest advocacy event to protect the lives of the unborn. We hope to see you then.